If you hear Governor Dean speak, you will understand why this campaign has generated enthusiasm not seen in a generation, has brought in over 60,000 volunteers around the country, many of whom have never participated in a political campaign. And now it is my great pleasure to present to you our next president, our colleague, Dr. Howard Dean.
He's pretty good. I may be not the only doctor in this room that's running for political office. I think he's pretty good. Let me just say thanks to Andy and to Sandy both for allowing us to come into their incredibly beautiful house and doing this event, and to the host committee, and also want to recognize Dr. Dan Kelly, who's on the San Francisco Board of Education. Dr. Kelly, there you are. And one thing that I said to him is I know he really appreciates No Child Left Behind. Is anybody here a teacher? No teachers? The school board calls No Child Left Behind No School Board Left Standing, but teachers call it No Behind Left. We'll get into that part. That's not the usual part of the speech I start off with. But it might as well be. One of the things, I'm just going to have some fun here tonight. I've worked hard all day, and this is all doctors and colleagues, and I'm just going to enjoy myself. One of the things I do is I have this speech. I don't speak from notes, so I have a speech, and I've got about 25 things to say. Usually I only get through about 17 of them, and I don't know which 17 they're going to be until I'm done. And then the rest of them are all left for the questions. So we'll start in the middle of the speech with No Child Left Behind, since that's an odd place to start. And what it really is about, of course, is not about starting with education or something randomly, but there are a lot of reasons I'm running for president, and we're going to go through most of them. But one of the reasons I think we've been so successful is because this campaign has stood up and tried to make Democrats proud of being Democrats again. I was being interviewed by a guy today for a Newsweek, and they said, well, aren't your issues the same as everybody else's? And I said, well, they're pretty similar, but there are three big ones that are different. One, I did not support the war in Iraq. Two, I do not believe we ought to have tax cuts if we can't afford them, and everybody else voted for some cuts except for Bob Graham. And three, I think No Child Left Behind was an awful bill that was designed to take power away from local school boards. And essentially what the president did with No Child Left Behind is you decide to use Texas, which has consistently been in the bottom five states in the country for education as far along as you can think of, and use that as a model for the rest of the country in terms of how its schools should be run. And I don't think that the strategy of the Democrats from Washington is going to work. Because what it is essentially is, let's be enough like the president so maybe we can take a few hundred thousand votes away from him and win. The reason Democrats can't win elections in this country is because 50% of Americans don't vote and we don't give them a reason to vote. And the way I'm going to beat George Bush is to give 3 or 4 million of those people a reason to come back in to vote and stand up and be proud to be Democrats again. And they will vote, and they certainly aren't going to vote for George Bush. And this time, the person with the most votes had better win. I think if you can't get two things right when you're running for president and when you are the president, then you're in big trouble. We're going to talk about health insurance. We're going to talk about investment in kids and talk about the environment. But if you can't get foreign policy and economic policy right, then you've got a big problem being president of the United States, which I think entitles the president to a free trip back to Crawford, Texas. And the fact is, let's talk about economics. No Republican president has balanced the budget in 34 years. If you want to trust your hard-earned dollars to the federal government because you have to pay taxes, you had better elect a Democrat because the Republicans cannot handle money. Borrow and spend, borrow and spend. This is the credit card presidency. And why does this make a difference? Isn't this a funny lecture coming from a Democrat? Because, first of all, if you want jobs in this country again, you have to balance the budget. When Bill Clinton balanced the budget 1993 without a single Republican vote, that began the process of having people begin to think that America was serious about dealing with the deficits, that America was a good place to invest, and that created jobs. So that's the first reason. You've got to run the country properly financially if you're going to have an atmosphere in which you can create jobs. The second is, if you want social justice, you have to balance the budget. And this state is an easy state to make this case in. Andy told you about the financial record. We also paid off a quarter of the state's debt while all this was going on. and raised our bond rating to the best in New England. Now, 12 years we balanced the budget. In the last 3 years, you know what's happened in California. The same thing's happened in every state. Revenues are down. We are not cutting K through 12. We are not cutting higher education. We are not cutting kids off Medicaid. We are not cutting aids to cities and towns, and we still have a balanced budget. The time that the revenues for the federal and state governments turn down is exactly the time that people who depend on the federal and state governments need the most help. And we're not just talking about poor people. We're talking about middle-class people who are afraid to send their kids to the public schools because the class size is increasing, property taxes are going up, and class offerings are decreasing. Middle-class people who can't afford, and I've met some of them since I've been here in California, can't afford to go to the community colleges anymore because the tuition is skyrocketing, as it has at the University, I think, of San Francisco. And the trustees have voted all around the system to raise their tuition 25% and maybe an additional 5% in the fall because state payments can't keep up, and that's because this president cannot manage the economy. We can do better than that, but it requires fiscal discipline of the kind that Republicans no longer do. Thank you. That's true. And the people who paid for the president's tax cuts are you. Most people in this country didn't get a tax cut. People say, well, Governor, you're running saying you're going to repeal the president's tax cuts. I feel like I'm on safe ground because if you ask people, would you rather have the president's tax cut or would you like health insurance that can't be taken away? Would you rather have the president's tax cuts or shall we fully fund special education to help lower property taxes and improve schools? Would you rather have the president's tax cut or shall we start to balance the budget so we can have jobs again in this country? Most Americans are going to pick jobs, health care, and education because they didn't get the president's tax cut. In fact, my guess is, although this is doctors, so I'm taking somewhat of a risk here, my guess is that a lot of people in this room who got the president's tax cut saw their property taxes go up significantly more than the income tax reduction that they got from the president because schools were shorted. Homeland Security was shorted. No Child Left Behind was unfunded. Special education was unfunded. All these things that have to be paid for by the local governments, so your taxes probably went up as much as the reduction that you may have gotten. I'd said this in New Hampshire one time, and a guy got up and said, well, Governor, I have to admit you may make some sense. I said, I got that check from the president for $600, but my 401k went down $60,000. I think I was better off before the president's tax cut. And all I will say is to most Americans would be very happy to pay the taxes they paid when Bill Clinton was president if only they could have the economy they had when Bill Clinton was president. Let's talk about foreign policy. I didn't support the war. I did support the attack on Afghanistan because I thought that was a danger to the United States. I supported the first Gulf War. I supported the intervention by President Clinton in Bosnia and Kosovo because I think stopping genocide is a worthwhile employment of American troops. But I didn't support the Iraq War. Why? Because the president never made his case. I am under attack from my rivals and undoubtedly eventually from the Republicans because what kind of foreign policy experience does a guy who runs a state of 600,000 people have? I'll tell you what kind of foreign policy service experience my team and I have. We figured out last October that the president wasn't telling the truth about the deal with Niger for uranium. We figured out last October that there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And if all these guys are so smart that are in Washington, how come they didn't ask those questions until 9 months after the war? But the foreign policy questions I have for the president are not just about the war. The foreign policy concerns I have are his willingness to unilaterally do whatever he pleases. His foreign policy motto is, get out of my way or I'll see you in the playground after school. That's not good enough. I want a foreign policy based on cooperation. This president is weak on defense, not strong, and we ought to say so. First of all, he's chosen tax cuts instead of buying the enriched uranium stocks of the former Soviet Union, as we're entitled to do under the Cooperative Threat Reduction. He's chosen tax cuts instead of funding Homeland Security, for San Francisco, for other cities, and for states. He's chosen tax cuts instead of inspecting the 94% of the cargo containers that come into this country uninspected. He has an oil policy which is essentially, let's drill in the national parks, and our oil money goes to other countries in the Middle East, which is then used to fund Hamas and fund the teaching of small children to hate Americans, Christians, and Jews. This is a president who's making our world more dangerous, not less dangerous, and we need to call him on it. And this president who talks so big about defense, on his watch, the military bailed him out. The military in this country works pretty well. So he sent them to Afghanistan, but then he couldn't keep the peace because we need four times as many troops there so we don't have to make deals with warlords who are anti-woman and anti-democratic. Imagine making people deals with the very people who are on the Taliban side when we went in. Then we send people to Iraq. The military does a great job and gets rid of Saddam Hussein. Now he can't maintain the peace because they never did think about what would happen if the military actually did a great job. And under this president's anti-communist, hardline, macho foreign policy, he is about to allow North Korea to become a nuclear power because he refuses to enter into bilateral negotiations. This president is all hat and no cattle when it comes to foreign policy. We need a world in which cooperation and rejoining the world community plays a high priority. We need a world based on cooperation, a foreign policy based on cooperation. I'd like to see, if I were president, I'd like to see if this president would ever do it, the United Nations and NATO be responsible for the occupation of Iraq, not the United States. I'd like to see the United Nations and NATO be responsible for rebuilding Afghanistan and democracy, not just the United States. I'd like to see the beginning of bilateral negotiations with the North Koreans, because we have nothing to lose. A nuclear war is unthinkable, and we need to do better than that. And there was a terrific article by the former Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, in USA Today, who works down at Stanford, who is probably the best defense secretary both parties acknowledge in the last 20 years. He thinks that we may be getting the position that nuclear war with North Korea is inevitable. That is a sad day. A sad day if this president permits that. It is inexcusable. We need a new president desperately right now. Let me just close the piece of foreign policy by saying this. We're still the most powerful country in the world, but we're no longer the most respected. And let me just turn back to the record of America a decade ago. The Soviet Union was dismantled. The Berlin Wall came down. We did not fire a shot. It's true, we had the strongest military, and that was important. But the reason it happened is because we had a better ideal. People on the other side of the Iron Curtain wanted to be like us. We have forfeited that moral posture in the world. Leadership is not just having the strongest military. It's having high moral purpose so that other people admire us and want to be like us. And under this president, we have lost that, and we've got to get it back. Talk briefly about health insurance. In our state, everybody under 18 has health insurance, 99% eligible, 96% signed up. Everybody under 150% of poverty has health insurance. If we can do that in a small rural state, 26th in income in the country, and balanced budgets, surely the most powerful and wealthy society on the face of the earth can join the Japanese, the French, the Germans, the Israelis, the Canadians, the Italians, the Irish, and on the list goes. Even the Costa Ricans have health insurance for all their people. We don't need to be second-class citizens anymore because the President of the United States wants to give $3 trillion tax cuts to Ken Lay and the boys back in Texas. And since there's lots of medical people here, I'll take a second to tell you how it can be done, and my plan's pretty easy. We're going to use essentially Medicaid as a middle-class entitlement to insure everybody under 25. When we did that up to 18, we had to raise reimbursement levels, or all the pediatricians are out of business. Then, under 185, are you cheering for out of business or are you a pediatrician? Everybody under 185% of poverty is essentially eligible for SCHIP. You've got to raise reimbursement levels to do that. Everybody else who's uninsured gets to buy into the same plan your congressman has, a private insurance program, for 7.5% of your gross income. If you're self-employed, you're making $40,000 a year, you have diabetes, hypertension, who knows what else, you can buy in for 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. You cannot be turned down, guaranteed issue, which we have in Vermont. You pay the same amount as a 25-year-old, 26-year-old, which community rating, which we have in Vermont. Everybody's covered, everybody's signed up, you can opt out if you want to, that's it. All we're doing is expanding the present system to include everybody. We're not reforming the system, because I've learned if you try to reform the system, the Democrats fight among each other about how to do it, and the special interests and the Republicans come in and kill the bill, and the losers are the 42 million people with no health insurance for another decade until another Democratic president comes along. This will pass. We've done most of it in Vermont. It makes sense. And most of the interest groups that oppose the Clinton plan will support this plan. Finally, let me talk to you about one other issue, and that is early intervention. Most of you know that we have almost 2 million people in prison in this country. Now, prisons are a necessary part of American life. You can't have violent folks walking around. But the truth is that prisons are the most expensive and the least effective social service intervention that we do. And any competent, qualified kindergarten teacher can tell you who the 5 kids are in his or her class that are likely to end up in prison 15 or 20 years from now. So my question is, if we have some idea who's going to use the most expensive and the least effective social service intervention that we do, 15 years before they use the intervention, why don't we invest something now in small children and their families to stop that from happening? Yes. And so we do. In our state, we visit every mother who gives birth in the hospital, whether she's the wealthiest or the poorest woman in the state. We ask them if they'd like a home follow-up visit. 91% say yes, so we visit 91% of all newborns within 2 or 3 weeks of their birth. Most of those families don't need any help, but the ones that do get health care, child care, job training skills, parenting skills, and programs to keep the dads interested in the kids, since many of them are single moms. That was 10 years ago. Don't need the best part. That was 10 years ago, or actually 11, that we started that. 10 years later, child abuse down 43%, child sexual abuse down 70%, and 10 years from now, those are kids that are going to go to college instead of prison. That's what you have to do in this country if you want to change it. Unless you think that this only works in the second whitest state in the country that's a rural, small state, the same thing is going on in central Los Angeles, in a 97% Latino neighborhood, and a center called Mar Vista, which is funded principally by corporate donations. You can do this any place unless you've got, if you've got strong leadership that wants to help families, and it will work all over America, community by community. I'm going to close by telling a story, because there's so many doctors here, and I'm going to tell at the expense of one of the people who's here, although he runs CMS in San Francisco, but he wasn't running it at the time I'm going to tell this story. But there are two campaign promises I make to doctors. One is that I'll actually have a practicing, somebody who's actually laid hands on patients running the equivalent of HICVA, and which is CMS now, Medicaid and Medicare. And the other is that somebody who's actually laid hands on patients is going to run the FDA. And so, you know, I like that applause. But here, I got to tell the following story, because I was going to get to it in the question period anyway, so I might as well tell it. It was right after I became governor. My wife Judy is a full-time practicing physician, internist, and we shared a practice with another doctor before I became governor. And I'm driving down, or being driven down the road about 2.5 hours south to a town to give a speech in, and the phone in the car rings, and it's my wife, in the tone that every married person knows that what your spouse's problem was is now your problem. And she says, look, the bookkeeper's in tears. We got a notice from HICVA saying that we were all going to go to jail for 6 years and a $20,000 fine if we didn't fill out 48 forms that were due last week, but we didn't get the forms filled next week, and on and on. Those of you who are physicians know exactly what I'm talking about. So I said, this is no problem. I know the people who run Medicaid and Medicare in Vermont, so I'll just call them up. So I call up, and I get a phone call, a recording that says, well, we're only open on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so you got to call Maine. So I call Maine, and I get a live person, which astonishes me. And the person says, we're awfully busy right now, but can you wait for 10 minutes and we'll get right to you? So I thought that was pretty good. So we're driving along, and 10 minutes goes by, and I'm hanging on the phone, and the person comes back on. Well, we're very busy, but if you wait 10 more minutes, we'll get to you. So the third time this goes on again, and 10 more minutes, but we promise we'll get right to you. So now, for those of you who know anything about Vermont, we've passed White River Junction. We're headed to Brattleboro, and we only have about 40 minutes before we get to Brattleboro, and I got to give a speech, and I realize it's going to take some time on the phone, so I'm really frustrated. And I did something I hardly ever do, and I'm embarrassed to even say that I did it, but I did it. She gets back on the phone and says, I'm sorry, it'll be in 10 minutes. And I say, wait, you don't understand. I'm not just some doctor. I'm the governor. I'm the governor of Vermont. Thank you very much. It'll be 10 more minutes. And if you just... Thank you very much. I am happy to take comments, questions, and rude remarks as necessary. Only two? We're in a yank to get out? I talk too long? We'll cheat. We'll take three.
The answer is only two questions.
All right. I'll answer short. Yes?
Could you talk about U.S. funding of the UN and also all the international treaties that we have refused to ratify and sign?
The question is about international treaties and UN funding. The UN is not perfect. I mean, an organization that elects Syria as the head of the Human Rights Committee is a problem, but the UN is all we've got, and we need to work constructively with them. I actually think that some of the funding withholding that went on in the 80s turned out to be the right thing, even though it was initiated by somebody who I thought was pretty despicable, which was Jesse Helms. But in general, we need to be supportive of the UN and part of that community, because I think it's all we've got, and talk is always better than war. Until you get to the very last resort. Secondly, the president does have an allergy to treaties, and there are lots of them. Most of them we just ought to sign, period. We ought to sign the International Treaty on the Rights of Women. We ought to sign the International Treaty on the Rights of Children. We ought to sign the Landmines Treaty. I don't agree with Bill Clinton on that one. Bill Clinton did not sign the Landmines Treaty because he felt that we needed the landmines in the DMZ in North Korea. But if we're already withdrawing troops from the DMZ, I believe that we ought to sign that. In my experience, and I've been in over 50 countries, cluster bombs and landmines principally kill small children or maim them, and they rarely are used effectively against troops, and we need to sign that. Now, here's the irony. The president sends troops to Iraq because Saddam Hussein might have biological weapons. Guess who hasn't signed the International Treaty on Limiting Biological Weapons? There's another one. Some of them are more problematic. The International Criminal Court is very complicated, and those kinds of things have been used as political weapons, so we need to be careful, but in the end, we need to find a way to sign that, if we can modify it or whatever. Kyoto, very complicated, but instead of discarding it, there's some things that should happen in Kyoto anyway that are good for the environment. We should try to find a way to sign Kyoto. So in general, the treaties that we have been part of, we need to find a way to sign. Either just sign them outright and stop being silly about them, which is most of them, or some of the more complicated ones, look at them and see if there's a cooperative way that we can work with the world community to make some advances. All the way in the back.
As a physician, do you think the federal government has any role in the malpractice crisis?
I actually don't. I'm a physician, and I know you have CAPS in California. I'll tell you about my favorite malpractice solution in a minute, but I think the legislation that the president is proposing is fraudulent, and it's typical George Bush. The reason I think it's fraudulent is because it's unconstitutional. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't understand how it's constitutional for the federal government to write the laws under which state courts practice and limit rewards. So even though many of us might like to see CAPS because we're upset at this tremendous malpractice crisis that we have, it just seems to me that I'd like a realistic solution. Now, let me tell you what I think the best solution is, but if states want to enact CAPS, you have one here. I assume it works reasonably well because you also have good insurance regulation that goes along with it, which prevents insurance companies from undercutting the market and expanding their market and then having enormous spikes when the stock market goes down. My favorite version of tort reform is what they have in Maine, which is pre-arbitration panels composed of a judge, a lawyer, and a doctor, so that frivolous claims are sued out. There's grumbling among both the lawyers and doctors, but most people like it. The lawyers like it because they feel it's fair, because if the judge is there, you're not really restricting access to the court. The judge makes the decision that the claim is frivolous or ought not to be heard. The doctors like it because it does weed out those kinds of lawsuits, which are expensive and mostly are not just expensive, but they wear on the physician all the time. Physicians are unlike lawyers. They're not used to being sued all the time. And a lawsuit really does wear one down. It calls into question doubts about your practice and your professionalism, and it's a really difficult thing to do. I'm used to being sued because governors get sued about 3 times a week. But I remember once we were threatened with a lawsuit, which turned out to be frivolous and fraudulent. It was only, interestingly enough, only by being a reputable malpractice attorney, not accepting the case, that we were not sued, which I thought spoke highly of the trial. The trial bar is not what doctors think it is. They're just like everybody else. There's some ones that are really unscrupulous and horrible, and there are some that try to do the right thing within the confines of the law. So my preference is to encourage states to enact pre-screening panels with judges on them to get out the frivolous stuff. In our state, juries don't do outrageous things because we're flinty Yankees that don't like to spend money. But there are states that have really serious problems, and they need to deal with this. But they are dealing with it because their problems have escalated to a position where now they have to deal with it. I'm going to try to take a few more. I know we have to go, but I really hate to. Yes.
The San Francisco Chronicle ran a front page article yesterday, I think it was, saying that you're the most recent incarnation of George McGovern and you can't win.
Who wrote it, John Kerry?
I'd like to know what your response to that is.
You know, I don't worry a lot about that because what's going to happen is, who did write that? Was it an opinion column?
It was a front page op-ed.
Okay. Front page op-ed. What is this, William Loeb's papers? The bottom line is, when people look at the record in Vermont, here's a guy that balanced budgets, which the president couldn't. Here's a guy that delivered health insurance, which the president has no interest in. Here's a guy that protects the environment, which the president doesn't know what that word means. It seems to me that my record against the president's record is going to be a record that's more compatible with what most Americans believe. Most Americans, I believe, are fiscally conservative and socially progressive. That's me, that's not the president. So we'll find out who's like more like McGovern in this race. Yes, we have to go? All right, I take the last one.
Governor Dean, one of the big issues that Democrats seem to come out on the losing end has to do with size of government. Republicans simplify things to wanting to have less government, and we seem to be labeled as wanting more government or big government. And it seems to me the best thing to do is to have good government, regardless of the side. Do you have any thoughts, based on your experience in Vermont or otherwise, about what we need to do about the federal government in general?
Well, one of the interesting things about this race is going to be that if I choose to, I'm probably not going to go down this road because I think the Republicans have really done us an enormous disservice by criticizing government. Government, in fact, has a lot more good roles than the Republicans or the American people believe, having listened to Ronald Reagan ad nauseum and Rush Limbaugh. But the truth is that this president has lost 3.5 million private sector jobs. Most candidates say he's lost 3 million private sector jobs. Most candidates say, oh, he just lost 3 million jobs. That's not true. He really only lost 2.5 million jobs because he added 434,000 people to the federal workforce. So let's talk about big government. Let me just close by saying, A, thank you very much because my handlers want me to go. Thank you very much. Secondly, let me close by saying this. I appreciate your support and your help. Raising money is important. And I also need you to go on the net at deanforamerica.com. Send us your email address. We promise not to spam you except for the last 3 weeks of each quarter when we're trying to raise a lot of money. But if you send us your email address, we will send you a lot of information about the campaign, and we want you to send it to your email addresses because your email list may have 100 people on it. Let's just say there's 100 people here. That's 10,000 people that we touch as a result of this meeting. That's how we're going to beat George Bush. That's how we're going to bring new people into the process. Most of the people that gave us money the last time never gave to political campaigns before, over 40,000 people. That's how we're going to beat them. At election time, the biggest lie that people tell is that if you vote for me, I'm going to solve all your problems. The real truth is that the power to take back this country is in your hands, not mine. Abraham Lincoln once said that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. This president has forgotten about ordinary people. You have the power to take this party back and make it something we can be proud of again. You have the power to take this country back and make it something we can be proud of again. And we have the power to take the White House back in 2004, and that is exactly what we're going to do. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I guess I'm going to be dragged out.
Thanks.
Was that right?
Yeah.